News Talk Breakfast with Ciara Kelly and Shane Coleman.
In association with AIR.
Weekday mornings at 7 on News Talk.
Good morning to Finance Minister Pascal Donoghue. Minister, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, let's talk inflation first of all. The numbers are frightening. Annualised 7% recorded last month for the month of April. How are people going to afford to do the basics?
Yes, indeed, Pat. I appreciate this is very difficult after the huge demands of a pandemic to now see the cost of living going up in the way it is. It's really difficult for many households, very difficult for many businesses. You know the reasons why? Things that were happening due to COVID, exacerbated by the war in Ukraine. What can the government do? Well, we can do a lot and we are doing our best. We've brought forward between our budget day announcements and in three different announcements since then, around €2 billion worth of measures to deal with the cost of energy, to help those who are at risk of fuel poverty, and even this week, an extension of the 9% VAT rate to avoid further price increases.
One of our listeners was wondering how you could do that unilaterally or continue to do it unilaterally when the EU tells us what to do about VAT on fuels.
Indeed, well, what the European Union does is the European Union sets, if you wish, the parameters inside which VAT decisions can be made. And the reason why they set the parameters is to ensure then that in the single market, where we sell our goods and services to each other, that nobody, no one country is trying to have an unfair advantage through the application of a different sales tax. And that's good for a small country that exports. But the decision that I made on the 9% rate is inside the parameters that the VAT gives me in relation to VAT.
So that's clarity there. We can't do it
on energy and gas
without the say-so. Speaking of gas, we know that a gas pipeline to Germany has been shut down, one that is designed, it appears, to cope with peak demand. Now, we're coming out of the winter, but Germany's a mighty industrial country. The price of gas has once again soared.
Indeed. And we, in the last economic forecast that we did, Pat, which we did in the month of April, we did indicate that as we move through the year, we did expect inflation to get to the level that it is. But we do expect, even with everything that it's going on, that it will begin to change as the year goes on and hopefully has the ability to come down in the second half of the year. What could influence this further, which is the premise of your question, would be whether the European Union were to take further decisions in relation to the supply of gas and oil. They've already made one now in relation to oil, and that could further change where we are with inflation. But this is why we've put in place the measures that I mentioned earlier on. Yeah. And it's why when we were prepare budget 2023, we'll clearly be conscious of the cost of living. But I do need to be just as open and honest as I can. We still do need to be careful. We have a very high level of a debt now due to the pandemic, due to all that happened before the pandemic. We can manage it safely. But just as during the pandemic, I was always called on month after month, frequently in your own studio here by those who wanted to put points to me, to do more and more, to increase the measures that we were doing, to increase the value of payments that we were doing. And we didn't do it during the pandemic, but we did get the balance right. We tried to do a lot, but we couldn't do everything. And because of that, we did get through the pandemic with our economy recovering and jobs growing, and we can do the same here.
Now, in terms of Germany, I heard the German ambassador on our business breakfast programme this morning saying, you know, the idea of sanctions is that you hurt the other person more than you hurt yourself. And this is the argument that Germany has about not embargoing Russian gas, or at least not doing it now and waiting for alternatives to be put in place. We, on the other hand, are not dependent on Russian gas, even though the wholesale price will be impacted by the general world market for gas. Do you understand the Germans?
Yes, I do. And I think if you look at the German economy, the Austrian economy, some other economies that would be towards the east of Europe, they have a very, very high level of dependency on gas that comes out of Russia, some of which is driven by history, other of which is driven by, you know, recent decisions that were made to get more gas out of Russia. And I do understand where they are coming from. And broadly, I do accept the argument that if these sanctions are going to be in place for quite some time, and I think there's every chance they will be, the allocation of difficulty of cost should sit on those who are being sanctioned rather than those who are putting in place the sanctions.
But if you stand back and you're a Martian who arrives on Earth and you see that the Germans are burning Russian gas in their munitions factories to make weapons that they're sending to the Ukrainians to fight the Russians, and then paying the Russians a huge amount, which they are using to fund their war machine. It's bunkers.
But I would also think the same Martian, if they were to be here, then more just for a single visit. If they were to look then at the effect of a broader sanction, which was to stop us purchasing energy from Russia, would then very quickly see economies in Europe experience even higher inflation and a very sharp reversal and change in economic growth, which then in turn would undermine our ability to enforce the sanctions that we have in place. Like the sanctions that have already happened on the Russian economy, and there's been multiple different rounds of them now, will have had a big effect on the Russian economy, but will have a far bigger effect on the Russian economy in the years to come and in the months to come, which in turn will undermine the ability of Russia to fund and maintain this awful war.
Now, moving on to other matters, I want to talk to you about the National Maternity Hospital saga in a moment, but more immediately and more critically, maybe in the short term, is what's going on in Northern Ireland. What Geoffrey Donaldson has done, they're not going to nominate a speaker today. He is resigning or temporarily standing aside from his MLA seat and going to continue in Westminster. And he's saying there'll be no change until we get our way. Stamping his foot is Geoffrey. What do you think is likely to unfold here?
I fear what is likely to unfold, is that we will move into an environment in which Northern Ireland executive is not formed. We're going to see that happen later on today, which will mean the people of Northern Ireland who voted for their different concerns to be dealt with in the recent Assembly elections won't have an Assembly that is in place to deal with it. And then in conjunction to that development taking place in Northern Ireland, there's every possibility now that we see the government of the United Kingdom go ahead and take unilateral action on a protocol which is supported by the majority of members of the Assembly. That is the environment that I think we're going to be moving into, which is why through the European Union, Ireland and the Commission will continue to make the case for the protocol as being the only arrangement that is possible.
Were you a bit surprised yesterday when Commissioner Sefcovic said that the EU would do its utmost to protect Ireland's position in the single market? I was a bit concerned, you know, it wasn't a bottom line, it was just we'll do our utmost. I was a bit concerned that in some way our access to the single market might end up being compromised by all of this going on by Boris Johnson and his colleagues.
That will not happen. Our membership of the single market, our full and unfettered access to the trade of goods and services to other members of the European Union is one of the cornerstones of our economy.
Okay, but that means accepting, if Britain does what it does, messes about with the protocol, breaks an international treaty, it means that we'll have to accept, if you like, a leaky access to the single market from Britain through Northern Ireland into the Republic of Ireland and thence into other European markets.
Which is why, being very clear, that the application of the protocol is the only solution for avoiding something like that. And what the European Union and the Commission have also committed to, and I believe demonstrated, is inside the protocol, trying to find the maximum flexibility regarding how it is implemented and how it is, you know, operationalised to deal with practical and tangible issues that have been risen. But let me just emphasise this again. You know, the Brexit proposition and all of the claims around it had so many contradictions, so many inconsistencies, and we cannot and will allow them to be played out in such a way that affects our membership of the single market. And Commissioner Sefcovic and the Commission, in fairness to them, have been implacable in their support for Ireland's stance on this matter.
Okay, I'm just trying to see how it might be resolved. If the British are determined not to do those checks in the Irish Sea, and therefore goods might come into Northern Ireland unhindered by checks, and thence, because we have an open border, into the Republic and therefore into the single market, how is that to be resolved?
But this is the very kind of risk that the protocol was designed to deal with. And what we will do is and this view, this perspective is being, you know, so professionally and strongly communicated by the Commission on our behalf, is make the case for a protocol and the protocol that can avoid that risk and avoid the border and all of the political and security difficulties around that.
Now, on this programme and with you in studio, I'm sure we talked about how damaged Britain would be by Brexit, and so it has turned out. I mean, this is not hasn't been the great adventure they thought it was going to be. But if the EU does respond in kind and decides to suspend the trade agreement with Britain, which is quite generous, I think, given their attitude to the European Union, then we are up against the notion that Britain would decide to export via Northern Ireland and therefore the Republic of Ireland into the single market to get around those restrictions that the EU would impose.
Yes, such risks then do begin to develop, but the additional and broader risk that would develop is the free trade agreement, which is also really important to the United Kingdom to be able to maintain the trade of goods in particular with the European Union. That would also then cease to operate in the way it is at the moment. So yeah, you are right about the level of risk that could develop for Ireland and other economies that do business through Northern Ireland, but that's mainly a risk for Ireland. But also very big risks would begin to develop for the ability of the United Kingdom to trade with Europe. And I expect that would be taken into account in any final decision that's made. Look, it's not for me to speculate or offer conjecture on what the UK will do. I'll simply say that number one, an agreement was made. When that agreement was made, all knew what was in it. We expect such an agreement to be honoured. And number two, if an agreement that was made and signed up to that has an international status, that if that is then unilaterally breached, the consequences that will flow from that will be immense. Yeah.
Does it stick in your craw to watch Boris Johnson prancing around the European stage and, you know, giving out about Putin's breaching of international norms, and he himself as an advocate of breaching an international treaty?
There's little to be gained by me adding to the kind of language that I frequently hear politicians in the United Kingdom use for describing where we are with Brexit. The key thing is we need to find a way of resolving this. And
but
the close call
isn't
has it, to be
isn't
on
it sick-making to watch this kind of carry on?
Look, if I look at where we are with Brexit now and I look at all the different claims that were made before the vote happened, and if I look at all of the things that have happened since then, of course, it is a source for frustration for those of us who've been involved in dealing with the consequences of Brexit, like I have. I, like any other Irish person, wasn't involved in the Brexit vote, wasn't involved in casting a vote for it. We did indicate that things could happen as a result of such a decision. And unfortunately, many of the concerns and, you know, views that we had regarding the difficulty that could develop has happened. But where I have to put all my energy and where those of us that are in government have to put our energy on is working on a way through this. But that has to involve the implementation and support of the protocol.
Now, harking back briefly to Ukraine and its implications for us here, we've had the extraordinary situation of the Russian ambassador who basically lied. He lied barefacedly to me. He lied to others about the prospect of Russia invading Ukraine. But then he would say that anyway. He's his master's voice. That's what ambassadors are. He needs his papers renewed, his visa extended. Should we keep him or throw him out?
We should keep him. And I know this is a difficult argument to make, but the reason we should keep him is even in such appalling circumstances as we are now in, countries do need to talk to each other. We have Irish people in Russia.
No, but I mean, we would get another one if we turned down his papers. They'd send another candidate, presumably of the same ilk. And
I think that's quite an assumption. Now, if we were to turn down his application for continued residency here, the idea that Russia would then decide, well, we'll just send over somebody else, is an assumption.
You don't think that would happen?
I think it's unlikely.
They would see it as a slight if we turned Ambassador Filatov's application down?
Every possibility that could happen. And what I have in mind is we have Irish people in Russia. Irish people in any other country, particularly one which is... involved in the kind of in the invasion that has taken place in Ukraine. But Irish people are still there. They need support. They need diplomatic representation. They could need our help at some point in the future. And that's why I want Irish diplomats in Russia. I want Irish diplomatic staff who can be of help to Irish people. And if I'm willing to acknowledge that, then I also have to acknowledge that the quid pro quo, despite the frustration and despite the reaction that we can have to the points that have been made to the ambassador, is that an ambassador does have the right to be here in Ireland.
All right, moving on to the National Maternity Hospital saga, and I don't propose to talk to you about the legalities of that document. I mean, there are those who are for it and those who are against it. But the latest plea is really to delay things a little bit longer so that members of this new charity board could actually come before the Health Committee and testify. What is your view on that?
My view is the government should go ahead now and make a decision in relation to this. I do believe the additional 2 weeks that the Cabinet decided to put in place to consider this matter have been worthwhile. But I also do believe we are at a point now in which a decision should be made. And I know that Minister Donnelly and the Department of Health are working hard now to see if further clarifications and assurances can be provided.
One of the phrases which was inserted, it appears, by the HSE was this: clinically appropriate. Things that are legally permissible and clinically appropriate. This was the kind of description of the services that would be on offer. Peter Boylan was quite interesting yesterday when, you know, the safeguard is the minister with the golden chair, that he can override or she can override anything that might be inimical to the interests of the people or the government of the day. But Peter Boylan was saying, like, when you have a phrase like clinically appropriate, and there's no guarantee that a Minister for Health would have any medical expertise at all.
So,
and making clinically appropriate or disappropriate decisions.
Well, the Minister for Health might not have clinical expertise, that is true, but he has an awful lot of people working for her or him that does. And far be it from me to question, and I would not, the expertise of Mr. Boylan, and I certainly would never question his intentions or bona fides on this matter. But what is equally relevant to me is all the clinicians and staff in the current National Maternity Hospital that are making the case for this decision to go ahead. And their voice is pretty clear in relation to it. And if I could offer an interpretation or view on what clinically appropriate means, what I believe it means, and this is the kind of thing that I know we will get clearer on when we make a decision, is there are many other services, health services, that a level 4 hospital and a hospital that will be of the size and status of the new National Maternity Hospital, you'd expect to provide, that don't have anything to do with maternity services. And what we're simply making clear here is that there are, this is a hospital that will be purely focused on maternal healthcare.
Okay. But is it a simple thing like saying these services will include, but this is not an exhaustive list? So in other words, it lists the thing that people are worried about, but because there will be probably very sophisticated new treatments developed in the next century or two, you don't exclude anything. But for the moment, to give people reassurance, you include everything that people are worried about.
Well, we do need to give ourselves the flexibility in any contract to ensure
a non-exhaustive
to ensure that as new services and new technologies, that as new technologies become available to deliver existing health services, that the hospital will have the ability to do this. But allow me just though to make the core point in relation to this, which is to say that all health services that our law allows to happen, that women and mothers need and deserve, will be available in this hospital.
Yeah, that's your belief, that people are concerned maybe with stem cells technologies and all this sort of stuff coming down the tracks. There may be ethical issues that a government of the day might have.
No, it's more than my belief. It is the intention of the government. I mean, the reason why we are going through this process, the reason why we were putting in place the National Maternity Hospital, the new National Maternity Hospital, the reason why the last government put so much effort, though this was led and enabled by the people of Ireland, into the decision that was made regarding the availability of abortion services in our country, is to ensure that the support, the services that women, that mothers, that their children will need, that all that is needed will be made available. And in the new hospital, when the decision is made, which I do believe we need to make soon, while I utterly understand the questions that have been raised about, and we have to do all we can to respond back to them, we will ensure that all of the services that are available under our law will be available in the hospital.
You know, Oscar Wilde, to lose one parent might be seen to be unfortunate, to lose two sounds like carelessness, I'm paraphrasing. To build one hospital in the wrong place, the children's hospital, might be seen as unfortunate. To build two hospitals in the wrong place might be seen as being a bit careless. The babies are not being born in D4, they're being born in West Dublin. There's no maternity hospital at the moment in West Dublin. Why is a billion euro facility being built far away from where the real need is?
But with respect, the journey from West Dublin into where the new hospital will be, you know, is one that our ambulances and all our healthcare staff would do really, really quickly. You know, any time we make a decision regarding the location of a new hospital or healthcare facility, it is always open to debate, always open to question.
Yeah, but the Merrion Road and the N11, I mean, they're not that easily navigated at rush hour at all.
We already have a very busy hospital there, which many patients are able to access. Not always easily, I acknowledge, but they are able to access it, and they're able to access it in such a way that allows them to get the state of our care that they need.
Okay, I'm going to park that. I'm sure we'll be talking about it again. Just some quick questions from our listeners or a suggestion. Stop the messing about on inflation and just reduce income tax. Put money in people's pockets and they'll be able to cope.
We made very significant changes in the last budget when we increased the rate of income at which you pay the lower rate of income tax. We've already made changes and have made them budget by budget.
Two questions of the 400 euro for facilitating a refugee family. Number one, is that enough? Is it sufficient? Will it be taxed? Is it seen as income?
Well, all income that state has made, you know, pays to its citizens is taxed. But whether you pay tax on it or not, it's taxable. But whether you pay tax on it or not does depend on your own circumstances and the level of income that you have. The government has to make a decision on this, and we're going to do this in the next couple of weeks.
But I mean, it could be seen as covering expenses in a firm. If you do certain things that are your expenses, you don't pay tax on those expenses. So if you're giving people bed and board and undertaking certain expenses, like part of the electricity bill, the gas bill, whatever, you might make them Wi-Fi available to them and so on and so forth. Why would expenses be taxable?
But I think, in fairness to all who were involved in this decision, I think monetary concerns and, you know, the costs of us, you know, people who have decided to take refugees into their home, you know, are doing it because they believe it's the right thing to do and they want to help. And, you know, we're so lucky to have so many who are looking to do it. I do understand the argument regarding it covering an expense, but it's also the case that, for example, job seekers' payments, the pandemic unemployment payment, the employment wage subsidy scheme, they were all taxed too. And a fundamental principle is that all income that we make available is taxed.
So someone who is not using up all their tax-free allowances, for example, might not pay any tax on such an allowance.
Well, that's certainly possible. And it has been the case, for example, on other payments that we've made available. And as I said, we haven't got to the point that we've made a final decision on that, and we'll do that very soon.
Okay. Last question, again, one suggested by a listener. Could you compel the members of the St. Vincent's holding group, the charity, to testify before an Oireachtas committee?
We only have really narrow circumstances in which we would compel somebody to come in front of the Oireachtas. To the best of my knowledge, those compellability powers, would not extend to somebody who's on a board like that, and I'd be very reluctant to change.
So Peter Boylan's request for, you know, possibly a vain request to get the details of any communications between the Vatican and the sisters and this group, but you'd get no answers to it.
But the government isn't involved in such a dialogue and it's such an exchange of information if one is happening. And I think we need to be very careful that even when we're dealing with matters in which there's an awful lot of public focus on and an awful lot of legitimate and understandable concern, then in our effort to make progress in those matters, we don't end up conferring powers on either the government or indeed on Parliament in relation to compatibility, in relation to the access of information that could be arbitrary and could even be excessive in the future. You know, we have to get the balance right. And we do have compatibility powers in the, in our parliament, but they are used very rarely. And I believe that is correct.
Minister for Finance, Pascal Donoghue, thank you very much for your time this morning. It's nice to see you in studio.
Thank you.
You've been here more than I've been here, actually.
Indeed, I got quite the land when I walked in and met you here. So that's good. And long may it continue, Pascal.
Thank you very much, Minister, for your time.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.